This is Seeking Delphi, episode number 37, The Future of Nursing and Caregiving, Part 2, with Oriana Badet and Anne Peschut. I'm Mark Sackler. The future lives here. In part one of this podcast, Dan and Ori, both of whom have nursing-related doctorates and are members of the Association of Professional Futurists, discuss with me the overview of foresight and innovation in nursing, why they are needed, and how they might be employed to deal with the challenges of personnel shortages and a globally aging population. In part two, Ori and Dan return to drill down to some of the critical sub-issues, including the deployment of new technologies. Dan, Ori, welcome back for part two of this discussion.
Hey, good to be here.
We've already heard your backgrounds in part one. We'll dispense with that. I want to, in this episode, in this session, get to some specific challenges and how maybe they are being addressed and how they're going to be addressed going forward. And obviously, automation, artificial intelligence is a big one. Now, I've had two podcasts in the past, one with noted British futurist Ian Pearson, and another one with Alexandra Whittington, who is an instructor at University of Houston, where I got my graduate certificate in foresight. And both of them seem to think that there's going to be more need going forward for those who can give care with empathy to be the go-between between the technology. In other words, it's the more rote jobs that are going to go first, but I'd like to know what your experience has been. And Oriana, since you're more the practitioner, let's start with you. What's the present state and where do you see it going in the next several years in terms of automation and AI?
You know, I think we are seeing growth in both spaces rapidly in the healthcare environment as we are looking at how industry is entering this space. By this space, I mean healthcare. We're seeing the partnership between Berkshire Hathaway and Amazon and JP Morgan Chase, looking at how they're starting a brand new health system that's being led by Atul Gawande, and they're entering that health space and how are they providing care to their employees. And really that group is going toe-to-toe with Walmart, who is launching Walmart Health. And in that space, their employee populations are about the same. They're right about 1.5 million. And so in that space, they are testing new models for care. They're testing, they're looking at data, how is care provided. In the physical healthcare, traditional healthcare spaces, we're seeing a lot of automation in our laboratory and pharmacy spaces. I would say that where we're seeing the most consistency of automation, especially with new builds and as they're trying to meet new standards for lab and pharmacy spaces moving forward. But I would say the use of artificial intelligence in healthcare, we're seeing it play out in a lot of different spaces. I would say one leader in this space right now is Geisinger Health. As Geisinger Health has partnered with Apple, every patient who enters a Geisinger Health system, they receive their iPad. That's how they get their schedule for the day. That's how they're communicating with their care team. And all of these large tech companies that are partnering with health systems are all studying that data. We saw the recent partnership that was announced just a couple of weeks ago between Mayo and Google Cloud, and how are they going to use all of this data that is created by healthcare systems to start creating more knowledge-based precision care and essentially scaling it to broader population groups. We're seeing artificial intelligence being used in the physical environment. There is a group of nurses who invented technology that sits on a just it's a, It almost looks like a small, maybe it could be like a fire alarm or something that's on the wall, but it's actually monitoring every person who comes into the room. They know how long the people were in the room. They can tell if the nurses were doing a bedside shift report. So, and with that, they can tell, that technology can tell when a patient gets out of bed, and how does that then impact the care. That same system lets staff know when somebody hasn't, when maybe you need to go check on a patient. So we're seeing the use of artificial intelligence and automation in our spaces already, but I think that's only going to increase. We have in healthcare, we have a huge amount of data within our electronic health records, but actually making that data actionable is going to be, I would say, the focus of the next, probably in the next 10 years of healthcare.
I would agree with that. Can I
go ahead.
Chime in with that? So the big shift we're seeing here is one that was predicted by Clem Beazeld long ago, and that was in healthcare, moving from a diagnose and treat to a predict and manage paradigm. And so it used to be that people would diagnose diabetes and they would treat it over time and it would just get worse and there would be complications. But if you can now predict with genomics or genetics kind of activity and splice out genes and do some kind of immunotherapy or gene therapy, the disease never manifests itself. And that is a huge, huge shift. And just to build on Ori's comments about health analytics and data science. Right now, the University of Minnesota School of Nursing has a partnership with Optum Labs, and we have data on over 1 million lives, and we can now mine that data and use machine learning to look at effectiveness of treatment, effectiveness of drugs, and bring those kind of knowledge discoveries back to the clinical area to make a difference in terms of care delivery and service.
So if I listen to this, it sounds like right now and in the immediate future, over the next 5 to 10 years, you're seeing automation, artificial intelligence as a way to leverage what the nurses are doing, make them more efficient, give them more knowledge, and perhaps be able to handle heavier loads as we have a shortage. But let's take it a step further than that. And here's the scenario. Are we going to get to the point where the shortage is so acute that we really need robotic nurses? I wouldn't be surprised if they're already doing that in Japan.
Yep.
Well, you know, I think even before we get to that step, part of understanding the use of artificial intelligence in healthcare is understanding the algorithms that are being built. And in healthcare, when you come in to see a healthcare professional, you are an N of one. But when we start applying algorithms to healthcare, if a population is not of a robust enough size, right now algorithms are automatically dismissing those patients. So as these systems are being built, I think it is absolutely critical that healthcare professionals and nurses and leaders are included in the design of those programs, because we have already seen the research that shows the bias in those algorithms if we do not understand what's actually being calculated. So as those systems are making inferences about what a patient might actually need related to a medication or a treatment, and as providers are trying to utilize that information, we need to know that that information is reliable. And I don't see any immediate shift in the need for people actually providing that care, but it will be, I think that the most transformative aspects of that care will be in how we deliver that care and where it's actually delivered. So I don't see robots immediately taking over in the United States, but recognizing that, you know, we are seeing that different systems being utilized within homes as we're looking at how our aging population is interacting with their Alexas in their home, right? Their smart technology. And how are we providing, and we're seeing new healthcare models and business models that are introducing that smart technology to actually do health checks with a patient or a person at home and doing a check-in. And so I think we're going to see it not necessarily with a physical creation of robots, but through the daily interaction of people with smart technology that's embedded in their homes.
And I'll just add, I'm old enough to remember C. Everett Koop, who was once upon a time the Surgeon General, wrote a great, he had a vision for healthcare in America. It was called the Belmont Vision. And in that Belmont Vision, he called for the creation of community healthcare workers. And in some communities across the country, people are doing that. And actually, there are not going to be enough healthcare providers to go around. And so one of his predictions was a shift to what he called kin care. These are going to be family members who are going to be taking care of people in their home, and they are going to need knowledge, skills, and coaching and action, accessibility to resources to help them manage that. And I'm just now reading a book by this guy, Jeffrey C. Bauer. The title of the book is Not What the Doctor Ordered, Liberating Caregivers and Empowering Consumers for Successful Health Reform. And he makes the argument that there are a lot of advanced practice practitioners in a variety of disciplines who could positively influence the healthcare delivery and service of people in the country if it were not for the medical monopoly and the way that things are currently structured in terms of reimbursement policies, services, and insurance. So we've got a lot of systemic factors that need to be negotiated in order to make healthcare accessible for all.
Well, and to that point, you know, I think about when we're talking about healthcare is, you know, the system that we have designed today was not created for the amount of complexity that our system now it exists in, right? And so in this space, you know, there is, we are trying to figure out how to navigate what the future of healthcare looks like. And I agree, you know, we're in this space where, you know, traditionally people entered a career and they receive their education and then they use that education for the rest of their kind of professional life or work. But now we're getting to the place where we're seeing we need to constantly iterate on the education that we have. We are constantly learning. We're learning something new. And how do we extend that education, like Dan said, to the communities, to the community care providers, and how will that change policy moving forward as we are looking to shift that care and some of that back to communities and to family members and community groups. And so there's some really interesting work that's being led by the Commonwealth Fund around how healthcare systems that are working with community groups can understand what that impact is by those groups in the community, and then how that impacts the healthcare system, and then also how the community groups can measure and essentially put a dollar amount to what they're providing healthcare systems. So I think we're going to just see continued growth in that space.
Well, obviously, costs forward, at least in the U.S. and even a lot of the world, even where the costs in the West aren't as out of control, the aging population is still going to place a burden in the future. If you've been listening to my podcast, so I'm going to go a little bit more out there in terms of disruption, and it's a little more speculative, but I'd love your views on what might happen, is that if you talk to those in the ending aging movement, and I have done several podcasts with that, including Aubrey de Grey, David Wood, Keith Comito of Leaf, Life Extension Advocacy Foundation, they'll tell you that the way to control healthcare costs is to eradicate the diseases of aging, which take up the lion's share of healthcare costs. If we were to see major progress in that area, and I'm thinking you're looking more like 20 to 30 years out before it would start to have a significant impact, that would change the whole paradigm. You'd be dealing more with natal issues, infectious diseases, and trauma than with the diseases of aging. I don't know, have either of you even considered those possibilities, or is it too far out for you to even look at it this time?
Well, I'm not a gerontologist, but we've got lots of people on our faculty who are, and they're looking at innovations in terms of helping people manage their activities of daily living, helping people exercise to prevent peripheral vascular disease, and they find that just doing exercise on a bike increases people's cognitive ability, and so there are all sorts of self-regulation things that people might be able to do to promote and maintain their health and prevent some of the adverse effects of aging that are more primary prevention as opposed to secondary or tertiary prevention. But then, of course, you've got the whole notion about health beliefs and motivational interviewing and how you can provide people the resources to do that. But even the augmented intelligence, you know, when Alexa says it's time to go for a walk or it's time to stand, I have my little Apple Watch on and it tells me periodically, oh, a minute of deep breathing will really help you at this point in time, or it's time to stand, you haven't reached your stand goal yet, or great, you've closed your exercise ring. There's all kinds of this immediate feedback that augments and helps people manage their health in a different way than in the past.
Yeah, you know, and Mark, I think, you know, what you're throwing out is, are we starting in healthcare to imagine futures that currently do not exist? So are we planning future scenarios where we can imagine moving from ill care to wellness models, right? Where all of a sudden our care is not episodic and based on disease management, but to prevention and wellness, and which will have a cascade effect around for our larger society and resources in those spaces. But I think these are the conversations that we need to have. And so tools that I use in when I'm working with healthcare systems are, I blend lean tools, I blend agile, I blend design thinking and foresight with strategic planning tools. And a lot of this is because, you know, what we're seeing in healthcare right now, because of the complexity and the rapid change in our system, is that we're seeing healthcare systems that are really moving to shorter and shorter strategic planning cycles, which is not allows them to address the immediate fires and needs of the community and the populations that they're trying to serve. But that long-range thinking around where are we going to be in 10 years, in 20 years, what could this look like? And I think there are healthcare systems who are doing this kind of work, and I can actually give you an example. So the Women and Children's Hospital that is in Toronto completely shifted their model from being a model of providing that episodic traditional healthcare, those services, to being a model that essentially said, we are going to move to a community-based model where we are imagining that we are the hospital that doesn't want to admit anybody. We are the hospital that wants to make sure that you're staying in your community. And what does that look like? And so when we think about people who are in systems that are trying to imagine what that future of healthcare can look like, there's a great model with Mount Sinai, and they have, it's called Lab 100. And Lab 100 is essentially a future wellness model that is being practiced today. And they are gathering data and they are working with individuals to essentially say, let's shift this conversation to be one of wellness. And I think that work is only going to continue to expand. And I think that we're already seeing that with the research that's being led today. And we know that there's a 17-year curve between the time that research is published to when it's actually implemented. And I'm working with a group and was just asked to be a founder for a new model that looks at how we use design thinking in healthcare in a way that actually allows us to embed what we know to be true through evidence-based design, and how do we start implementing and utilizing that research faster and faster, because in healthcare we know that we are not implementing the knowledge that we know today as fast as we should be. So there's going to be, I hope to share that work with you moving forward. But in this space, design thinking and foresight are really two sides of the same coin, because design thinking allows you to address an immediate issue in healthcare. It is micro. That's why we have ethnographers and anthropologists, and you go to the work, right? It's the Gemba, and you're seeing what's going on and what's the current state and how are we going to design for this immediate use. But the foresight and the scenario planning that you're talking about is all of a sudden it's the macro, right? This is about how are we designing for something that doesn't yet exist. And if you're doing strategic planning and you're working with your healthcare system, you have to be able to do both. Those executives who are in those positions recognize that they have to meet the immediate need, but they also need to be doing this long scaled planning into the future. And that's why those are two tools that I see being completely intertwined and moving forward in the foresight space.
Let's get one last issue here, at least that I have, and then we'll see if you guys have any challenges. And this is a very immediate one right now, but it's one that's only going to get worse And we're going to have to address both in the immediate and long-term future. And that's the problem of infection control with the rise of superbugs. We've had the recent occurrence of the drug-resistant fungal infection that has killed about several hundred people so far, at least in the U.S., maybe other countries. And I'm wondering where you see that going, both in the nearer and longer term, and what moves the nursing and caregiving world, obviously, because you're directly interfacing with and touching the patients. And within that, also, let's look at the possibility for a pandemic, which has happened in the past, in the distant past, you know, 100 years ago, the Spanish flu. But more recently, we've had some scares with Ebola, various other SARS, and various other near pandemics. So, Ariane, you're the practitioner. Why don't we start with you on that one?
You know, I think part of addressing, you know, I've done work in both infection prevention and emergency preparedness. And in that space, you know, moving care to people's out of traditional healthcare spaces and allowing people to stay in their homes and in their communities actually decreases the risk for the spread of some of this, some of these pathogens, some of these viruses. And in this space, I think that, you know, right now, we recognize in healthcare that we have an overutilization of antibiotics. We're not developing enough research fast enough around how to tackle some of the risks that are facing us immediately. There was some great work that was highlighted in the New York Times about a week ago, essentially looking at how microbiologists are studying ant populations who are essentially creating their own antimicrobials and how they manage fungus. And we're just starting to learn about some of this brilliance that is happening in our natural, kind of the natural ecology around us. And so how are we, you know, and in the midst of climate change, and we're seeing some of these habitats and different things disappearing before we truly understand the complexity of the natural environment, we are going to have to, in this space, continue to be incredibly aggressive. You know, we're seeing the spread of Ebola, and that's not being managed well. So in this space, as we're thinking about the future of healthcare and some of these trends, how are we going to provide medication? How are we going to reach communities? And I think about how one of the infrastructure planning pieces of the U.S. Postal Service is a way to deliver medications nationally. And how do we reach those communities and those rural environments? And that's one aspect of planning nationally for epidemic and pandemic resources is actually our U.S. postal system.
That's great. And I'll build on that in terms of Ori's notion about the complexity of this. So I had the good fortune to be on the board of the Plexus Institute several years ago. And it is an organization that's devoted to the application of complexity science to healthcare and communities. And one of their big projects was about using positive deviance to combat MRSA in organizations, trying to figure out, well, why don't you have MRSA here? And what do you do here that prevents you from having MRSA? And could we do that over there? And so they've published books on this. But the issue is really one of panarchy, right? And the Resilience Alliance. And there's a great resource about how to manage this called Liberating Structures at liberatingstructures.com. And the panarchy model is used with MRSA because you've got these dynamics going in terms of growth and development, and then there's a creative destruction, and then there's innovation, but they occur at different logical levels. So you've got the organisms changing, but you've also got the environments changing, and then you've got the individual actors in those environments changing, and then you've got the systems in those organizations changing, then you've got the industry changing, and then you've got the policy changing, and then you've got the greater community changing. So all of these different logical levels gives you a different perspective in terms of this dynamic complexity associated with the evolution and the development of infectious diseases and control. So helping people think more systems and more complexity at different logical levels is really going to be required. And that is so foreign to our scientistic, empirical way of going about things, wanting to divide things into smaller and smaller parts. We really need to become more integral in our thinking and understand not only what the individual brings, what the relationships brings, how the behaviors influence, but how the systems themselves interact, to sort of get that integral perspective if we're going to be successful in combating some of these things.
Well, and I think this is a blend of convergent and divergent thinking and tackling some of these problems. Like, we recognize that we need to hone down to figure out what's going on. But if we're going to create long-term solutions, we need to have that very broad picture divergent thinking. And you know, I think about when we have tackled, you know, I worked for a public safety net hospital for over a decade. And in that space and leading emergency preparedness, how we tackled emergent outbreaks related to, you know, people who are choosing not to get vaccinations in this space, right? We're about to lose our measles status globally. And so we're seeing these outbreaks of these highly contagious bacteria and viruses. And in that space, how we go about solving some of those problems. And these are, to do that, these are large scale community events where we are tracking every single person who comes into a building. We're minimizing the exposure and risk to the community, and how we start tracking and monitoring, and how we even, you know, manage the facility itself and airflow, and how do we close and care for communities. And when we were looking at, you know, as we started seeing the evolution of the, even the flu virus itself, when we saw, you know, the emergence of H1N1 and we started tracking some of these, we were seeing new care models that were being implemented where people would not even come into hospitals, that we were actually modeling how do we create drive-through care where people could just come to a healthcare facility. We can provide care and resources to them, and they never actually entered the facility. So, and all of these plans are being put in place. And I can tell you that local healthcare systems are working with partners at the regional and national level through CDC and NIH and how to tackle some of this work. But we are going to have to continue to be savvy and vigilant to make sure that we are providing safe care and resources for the community when these things do happen. Because as we're seeing the growth of populations, and we're seeing proximity and increasing risk, this is, we know that this is not a matter of if, it's just going to be when, and how do we provide those resources.
One last thing here, this is pretty open-ended, and you don't have to necessarily answer this if you think we've covered all the important points, but is there a disruption or any other disruption or challenge out there that concerns you that we need to, you think we need a long-term view of, and how are you going about addressing it?
Well, I could chime in here. I just was on a call with Ori yesterday. I think the big one is climate change, right? And Project Drawdown is a great resource for people, drawdown.org. There are so many people now that are interested in trying to positively influence climate change. There is a cluster, a little group that is trying to figure out what nurses around the world can do to support the Drawdown project. And so we're in a kind of a preliminary organizing phase to sort of figure out what are the four areas or five areas that nurses have influence in, and how might they use their professional nursing background, their leadership, and their influence to influence people in the community to implement some of these drawdown solutions that are based on science, that are actionable, that make it personal, but also make it professional and have an impact on the community. And this move towards planetary health is going to be key. So at the University of Minnesota, we're just now engaged in our strategic planning for the future, and one of our goals is going to be planetary health. And we just appointed Dr. Teddy Potter as our director of planetary health. And when we decided to launch this Foresight initiative at www.foresight-leadership.org, we define nursing foresight as the ability and act of forecasting what will be needed in the future, considering emergent healthcare trends, which have consequences for population and planetary health, as well as the profession's purpose, definition, professional scope, and standards of practice. So, you know, if the planet goes, we all go. And so it's pretty serious stuff. If we increase our temperature by 2 degrees or 4 degrees, it's going to have cascading consequences that we can positively influence today if we sort of have the foresight and insight to act.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to add something to that, Ariana?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think Dan is spot on. And I think, you know, we have to recognize that the healthcare system that we have is incredibly complex. And anybody who has entered our current healthcare system has experienced one of two things. They either moved easily through the system or they experienced where those breaks are and where they were lacking the support and resources to have a positive healthcare experience. And the challenges and opportunities for healthcare and healthcare professionals moving forward, those challenges are real. The opportunities are great. And I think the act of having healthcare professionals engage in the design and the creation of healthcare's future will actually prevent us from developing and redesigning the exact same system that we have and entropy within our system. And there's a great quote by E.F. Schumacher, and essentially the work was essentially talking about how that this new era will require a new orientation towards technology and towards interactions that are organic, they're gentle, they're beautiful. And in healthcare, we have a cultural conscience of do no harm. And healthcare is a medium right now where people, social injustices, purpose, and meaning all collide. We know that our healthcare industry is the largest employer across the United States. And with 4 million nurses in the United States, engaging them in thinking differently about healthcare and healthcare's future, we are going to see significant transformations. So part of this is reimagining and creating a new vision for the value that all of these professionals can add to our society and to healthcare itself.
Well, Dan, Ori, thanks so much for your insights here today and continued good luck in your efforts to bring foresight and innovation to healthcare.
Thank you, Mark, for your contributions. We appreciate you.
Mark, thank you for highlighting the work that's being led in healthcare and for having these conversations to talk about the importance of foresight across our society.
Healthcare, of course, is faced with daunting challenges right now, let alone in the future. As costs and complexity increase, work like that of Dan and Ori will become more important than ever. In upcoming episodes, we'll dig deeper into the future of healthcare, including an expert panel discussion on the challenges a post-aging society may face. But next time, we'll look at science fiction as a harbinger of things to come. Thanks for joining me. Be sure to subscribe to Seeking Delphi on Apple Podcasts, Player FM, or YouTube, and follow us on Facebook. My technical assistant is Mohammed Marouf. Until next time, I'm Mark Sackler.